A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about drug metabolism, that invisible chemical factory we're all walking around with, and specifically, the rule of thumb that it takes 5 half-lives for a drug to be essentially gone from your system. Does that actually hold up across different medications? What factors influence it beyond the obvious kidney and liver disease? And what's the deal with those liver enzymes you hear about in the context of grapefruit juice warnings on prescription bottles? Which, I'll be honest, is maybe the most unsettling 4 words you can read on a pharmacy label.
It really is. You pick up your statin, you're feeling responsible, and then the sticker says, avoid grapefruit juice, and suddenly you're wondering what else is lurking in your kitchen that's secretly at war with your medication. But that warning is actually a perfect entry point into this whole topic. It's not just a random prohibition, it's a window into the cytochrome P450 enzyme system, which is basically the body's chemical modification plant.
I think what makes this worth spending time on is that most of us take something, whether it's a daily medication or just the occasional ibuprofen. There's this entire hidden infrastructure of enzymes processing whatever we swallow, and we mostly just trust that it works. Understanding even a little of it changes how you think about dosing, about interactions, about why your doctor adjusts things as you get older.
So let's define what we're actually talking about. Drug metabolism is the body's way of transforming foreign compounds. Pharmacologists call them xenobiotics, into forms that are more water-soluble and easier to excrete. Because your kidneys are basically a filtration system that's very good at removing water-soluble stuff and very bad at removing fat-soluble stuff. If drugs stayed in their original fat-soluble form, they'd just keep getting reabsorbed and hang around indefinitely. So your liver steps in and chemically modifies them.
The liver is basically a customs and immigration department for molecules. If you show up fat-soluble, you get chemically stamped into something the exit lanes can handle.
That's not bad. And it happens in 2 broad phases. Phase 1 is functionalization, oxidation, reduction, hydrolysis. You're adding or exposing a reactive group on the molecule, like an oxygen atom, that serves as a chemical handle. Phase 2 is conjugation. You attach something big and water-soluble to that handle, like glucuronic acid or sulfate, and the whole package becomes much easier for the kidneys to flush out.
It's a 2-step assembly line. Step 1, install a hook. Step 2, hang a water-soluble tag on the hook and send it to the exit.
And that assembly line is what determines how long a drug sticks around, which brings us to the 5 half-life rule. Let's start there because it's one of those things that gets repeated so often. It's practically pharmacology folklore, and the reality is more interesting than the slogan.
Break it down. What is a half-life actually measuring, and where does the number 5 come from?
A drug's half-life is the time it takes for its concentration in your blood to drop by 50%. And most drugs follow what's called first-order kinetics, which means the rate of elimination is proportional to the concentration. The more drug that's present, the faster it's cleared. As the concentration drops, the clearance slows down. It's a percentage game, not a fixed amount game.
Like a bathtub drain where the water pressure pushes more volume through when the tub is full, and the flow weakens as the water level drops.
That's exactly the right image, and the math follows from that. After 1 half-life, you've eliminated 50%. After 2, you're at 25% remaining. After 3, 12.5%. After 4, 6.25%. After 5 half-lives, you've got 3.125% of the original drug still circulating.
Which means you've eliminated 96.875%, not 99%. The 99% figure everyone quotes is rounding.
It's a rounding convention, not a biochemical law. To actually hit 99% elimination, you need closer to 7 half-lives. 6 half-lives get you to 98.4%. 7 gets you to 99.2%. The 5 half-life rule is really saying 3% remaining is clinically negligible for most drugs, but whether that's actually true depends entirely on the drug's potency and its therapeutic window.
That's where the rule gets wobbly. If you're taking something with a narrow therapeutic index, that remaining 3% might still matter.
Digoxin is the classic example. It's used for heart failure and certain arrhythmias, and its therapeutic window is razor thin. The difference between an effective dose and a toxic dose is small. 3% residual digoxin from a previous dose, stacking on top of the next dose, can push you into toxicity territory. So for digoxin, clinicians don't just assume 5 half-lives makes everything fine. They monitor blood levels.
What about the other big exception to first-order kinetics? The drugs that don't follow the percentage rule at all?
That's zero-order kinetics, and it's where things get clinically dangerous if you don't understand what's happening. In zero-order elimination, the enzymes that clear the drug become saturated. They're working at maximum capacity, so they can only clear a fixed amount per hour regardless of how much drug is in your system. It's no longer a percentage. It's a constant rate.
The bathtub drain analogy flips. Instead of a drain that flows faster when the tub is fuller, you've got a fixed pump that can only move, say, 1 gallon per hour no matter what. If you're pouring in more than 1 gallon per hour, the tub overflows.
The 3 drugs everyone learns about in pharmacology training for this are alcohol, phenytoin, and high-dose aspirin. Alcohol is the one most people have personal experience with. At typical drinking levels, your liver's alcohol dehydrogenase enzymes are saturated. You eliminate roughly 1 standard drink per hour, about 7 to 10 grams of ethanol, regardless of whether your blood alcohol is 0.05 or 0.15. There's no half-life to calculate because it's not exponential decay.
Which is why the wait an hour per drink before driving rule actually has some pharmacological basis, unlike most folk wisdom about drugs.
And phenytoin is the one that really keeps neurologists up at night. It's an anti-seizure medication where the enzymes that clear it, primarily CYP2C9 and to some extent CYP2C19, get saturated at therapeutic doses. So you're cruising along at a dose that gives you a blood level of, say, 10 milligrams per liter, which is in the therapeutic range. The doctor increases the dose by just 30%, and suddenly your blood level jumps to 25 because the enzymes were already at capacity. You've gone from therapeutic to toxic with a tiny dose change.
That's terrifying. It's like a highway that's fine at 60 miles an hour, but at 62, the entire thing turns into a ditch.
That's the Michaelis-Menten saturation curve in action. At low concentrations, you get first-order kinetics. The rate increases with concentration. But as you approach the enzyme's maximum velocity, the curve flattens out. You hit Vmax, the maximum rate of reaction, and beyond that point, adding more substrate, more drug, just creates a backlog. The clearance rate stays fixed while the concentration climbs.
The 5 half-life rule holds for most drugs, but the exceptions are the ones that land people in the emergency room. Phenytoin toxicity. Alcohol poisoning where people don't realize they're still accumulating. Aspirin overdose in the elderly, where the kidneys and liver together can't keep up.
That brings us to the real heart of the question. What determines whether a drug follows first-order or zero-order kinetics, and what changes between different people? That's where the cytochrome P450 enzyme system comes in, and where the grapefruit juice warning finally makes sense.
Alright, let's open the hood.
The cytochrome P450 family, usually written as CYP450, is a superfamily of enzymes that handle roughly 75% of all drug metabolism. They're heme-containing proteins, which means they have an iron atom at their core, and they're found primarily in the liver and, for some of them, in the intestinal wall. They do the phase 1 work, oxidation primarily, adding oxygen atoms to drug molecules to create those chemical handles we talked about.
There isn't just one CYP450 enzyme, it's a whole team of specialists.
57 functional CYP genes in humans, though only about a dozen are heavily involved in drug metabolism. The big players are CYP3A4, CYP2D6, CYP2C9, CYP2C19, CYP1A2, and the distribution of labor is wildly uneven. CYP3A4 alone metabolizes roughly 50% of all marketed drugs. It's the workhorse. It's in your liver, and it's in the cells lining your small intestine, which is a detail that turns out to matter enormously for oral medications.
This is the grapefruit juice enzyme.
This is the grapefruit juice enzyme. Here's the mechanism. Grapefruit contains compounds called furanocoumarins, bergamotin and 6,7-dihydroxy. Bergamotin are the main ones. When you drink grapefruit juice, these furanocoumarins irreversibly inhibit CYP3A4 in your intestinal wall, not in your liver, in your gut. And it's irreversible, meaning the enzyme is destroyed. Your body has to synthesize new CYP3A4 to replace it, which takes about 24 to 48 hours.
It's not like the grapefruit compounds are competing for the enzyme's attention. They're taking the enzyme out back and shooting it.
That's the mechanism. They bind to the enzyme's active site and then form a covalent bond that permanently inactivates it. And here's why this matters for oral drugs. When you swallow a pill, the drug is absorbed through your intestinal wall and passes through the liver before reaching the rest of your body. CYP3A4 in the gut acts as a gatekeeper, metabolizing a portion of the drug before it even reaches circulation. This is called first-pass metabolism. If you knock out that intestinal CYP3A4 with grapefruit juice, more of the drug survives to reach your bloodstream.
The effective dose goes up, sometimes dramatically, because you've disabled the bouncer at the door.
The numbers are not subtle. A classic study by Lilja and colleagues back in 1998 showed that a single glass of grapefruit juice increased the area under the curve, the total drug exposure, of simvastatin by 3.5 times. For some calcium channel blockers like felodipine, it can be a fivefold increase. For certain immunosuppressants like cyclosporine, the interaction is significant enough that transplant centers specifically counsel patients about it.
3 to 5 times the intended dose from a glass of juice. That's not a minor interaction. That's taking 3 to 5 pills when your doctor prescribed one.
The clinical consequence for statins specifically is rhabdomyolysis, muscle breakdown that can cause kidney failure. It's rare, but it's serious enough that the FDA has maintained this warning for decades. And it's worth noting, this is grapefruit specifically, and to a lesser extent, Seville oranges, which are used in marmalade. Regular oranges don't contain significant furanocoumarins, neither do lemons or limes. It's a very specific botanical interaction.
The warning on the bottle is the pharmaceutical equivalent of, this machine has one specific enemy, and it's a breakfast fruit. What about the other CYP enzymes? You mentioned CYP2D6.
CYP2D6 is fascinating because it's the poster child for genetic variability in drug metabolism. It metabolizes about 25% of drugs. Antidepressants like fluoxetine and venlafaxine, antipsychotics, beta blockers, and importantly, codeine and tramadol. And here's the thing, the gene that codes for CYP2D6 is highly polymorphic. Different people have different variants, and those variants produce enzymes with wildly different activity levels.
This isn't just a minor variation. This is clinically significant differences between people.
About 7% of the population are poor metabolizers. They have gene variants that produce little to no functional CYP2D6 enzyme. For these people, drugs that rely on CYP2D6 for clearance will accumulate to higher levels and last longer. A standard dose of a tricyclic antidepressant might be toxic for them. On the flip side, about 1-2% of people are ultra-rapid metabolizers. They have multiple copies of the functional gene, so they produce excess enzyme and clear drugs much faster than expected.
Codeine is the one where this gets really dangerous, right?
Codeine is a prodrug. It doesn't do anything on its own. It has to be metabolized by CYP2D6 into morphine to provide pain relief. For a poor metabolizer, codeine is basically useless. They get no pain relief because their body can't convert it. But for an ultra-rapid metabolizer, a standard dose of codeine gets converted to morphine so fast and so completely that it can cause respiratory depression. The FDA issued a black box warning about this in 2013 after reports of children dying after taking standard codeine doses following tonsillectomy. They turned out to be ultra-rapid metabolizers.
The same dose of the same drug is either useless, effective, or lethal, depending on a genetic lottery that most people don't know they've entered.
That's why CYP2D6 genotyping is now clinically available and recommended before prescribing codeine or tramadol, especially in children. It's also relevant for tamoxifen, the breast cancer drug. Tamoxifen is also a prodrug. CYP2D6 converts it to endoxifen, which is the active metabolite. poor metabolizers may get less benefit from tamoxifen therapy, and there's been a long-running debate about whether CYP2D6 testing should be standard before starting treatment.
What about CYP2C9? That's the warfarin one, if I remember right.
Warfarin is metabolized primarily by CYP2C9, and there are two common variant alleles, CYP2C9*2 and CYP2C9*3, that reduce enzyme activity. Patients with one of these variants need about 30% lower warfarin doses. Patients with two variant copies may need 50 to 70% less. And if you don't know their genotype and you start them on a standard dose, they're at significantly higher risk of bleeding complications in the first few weeks of therapy.
Which is already the danger zone for warfarin. The first few weeks are when the clotting time is being stabilized and the risk of both clots and bleeds is highest.
And CYP2C19 is another one with clinical relevance. It activates clopidogrel, the antiplatelet drug used after heart attacks and stent placements. About 30% of people have reduced function, CYP2C19 variants, and they don't get adequate platelet inhibition from standard clopidogrel doses. The FDA added a boxed warning about this, and there are alternative antiplatelet drugs like ticagrelor that don't rely on CYP2C19 activation.
We've got this whole landscape of genetic variation that makes take one tablet daily, a kind of pharmacological fiction. The same instruction means different things to different people.
It's not just genetics. Age is a huge factor, and it's one that affects basically everyone eventually. Let's talk about what happens to drug metabolism as we get older.
This is the part where I start feeling personally attacked, but go on.
Liver mass decreases with age, about 20 to 30% reduction between age 30 and 70. Liver blood flow drops by roughly 0.5 to 1.5% per year after age 40. Since the liver's ability to clear drugs depends partly on how much blood flows through it, especially for drugs with high extraction ratios, this translates to a 20 to 40% reduction in clearance for many drugs by the time someone reaches 70.
The same dose that worked fine at 40 is effectively a higher dose at 70, just because the delivery system to the liver has slowed down and the processing plant has shrunk.
This is why geriatric pharmacology has this principle of start low, go slow. It's not just caution, it's pharmacokinetics. The elderly also tend to have reduced renal function, which affects excretion of the water-soluble metabolites we talked about earlier. And they're more likely to be on multiple medications, which means more potential for drug-drug interactions at the CYP450 level.
Polypharmacy plus reduced clearance. That's a recipe for adverse drug reactions.
It's a major cause of hospital admissions in the elderly. Something like 10 to 15% of emergency hospitalizations in older adults are medication-related, and a significant portion of those involve drugs that are metabolized by CYP450 enzymes where age-related changes weren't accounted for in the dosing.
What about the other end of the age spectrum?
Neonates have immature CYP450 systems. Most CYP enzymes are present at birth, but at significantly reduced levels, sometimes 10 to 20% of adult activity. CYP3A4 activity ramps up rapidly in the first few weeks of life. CYP2D6 matures more slowly. CYP1A2 doesn't reach adult levels until after the first year, so drug half-lives in newborns can be 2 to 5 times longer than in adults. The 5-half-life rule still applies mathematically, but each half-life is vastly extended.
Which makes dosing in neonatal intensive care incredibly tricky. You're not just adjusting for body weight, you're adjusting for an entirely different metabolic landscape.
Disease states add another layer. Cirrhosis reduces CYP450 activity by 30 to 50% depending on the severity and the specific enzyme. But here's a nuance that often gets missed. Not all metabolic pathways are equally affected. Some phase 2 enzymes, particularly glucuronidation, are relatively preserved even in moderate cirrhosis. So a drug that's primarily glucuronidated might not need as much dose adjustment as one that relies heavily on CYP450 oxidation.
Liver disease slows drug metabolism is too broad. It depends on which part of the liver's chemical factory is damaged and which enzyme handles the drug in question.
There's a surprising connection to kidney disease as well. Chronic kidney disease doesn't just reduce renal excretion, it also alters non-renal clearance. Uremic toxins that accumulate when kidneys fail can directly inhibit CYP450 enzymes. studies have shown that CYP3A4 activity can be reduced by 30 to 50% in patients with end-stage renal disease. So even drugs that are primarily metabolized by the liver may need dose adjustment in kidney failure.
That's counterintuitive. You'd think if the drug is metabolized by the liver, kidney function wouldn't matter for that step.
It's one of those physiological connections that isn't obvious until you see the data. The body systems don't operate in isolation. Metabolites build up, they feed back, they inhibit enzymes in other organs. It's a networked system, not a series of independent pipes.
We've got genetics, age, liver disease, kidney disease, and then there's diet. We started with grapefruit juice, but it's broader than that, right?
John's wort is the other famous dietary interaction. It's an herbal supplement used for depression, and it's a potent inducer of CYP3A4. Instead of inhibiting the enzyme like grapefruit, it cranks up production. More enzyme means faster metabolism, which means lower drug levels. John's wort can reduce the effectiveness of oral contraceptives, cyclosporin, and some HIV medications by so much that treatment failure occurs. There are case reports of transplant rejection in patients who started St. John's wort while on cyclosporine.
Grapefruit juice makes your drugs stronger by knocking out the enzyme. John's wort makes them weaker by building more enzyme. Same enzyme, opposite effects, both potentially dangerous.
Charbroiled meat induces CYCYP1A2. Cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and Brussels sprouts induce certain phase 2 enzymes. Chronic alcohol consumption induces CYP2E1, which is why heavy drinkers metabolize some anesthetics and pain medications differently. Smoking induces CYP1A2, which is why smokers often need higher doses of theophylline or clozapine. When they quit smoking, the enzyme induction fades, and suddenly their standard dose becomes an overdose.
The charbroiled meat one is just unfair. You're trying to be healthy, you grill some chicken, and suddenly your liver enzymes are upregulated.
The world is full of these interactions. Most of them are small enough not to matter clinically, but when you combine multiple factors, genetic variation, age-related decline, a dietary inducer or inhibitor, and maybe another drug competing for the same enzyme, the cumulative effect can push you out of the therapeutic window.
Which brings us to the practical question. If you're someone taking medications, what do you actually do with this information?
First, know which CYPA enzymes metabolize your drugs. This is not hard to find. The Flockhart CYP450 table is freely available online, maintained by Indiana University, and it lists which drugs are substrates, inhibitors, and inducers of each major CYP enzyme. If you're on a statin, check if it's metabolized by CYP3A4. Most are, though there are exceptions like pravastatin and rosuvastatin that largely bypass CYP450 metabolism. If your drug is a CYP3A4 substrate, avoid grapefruit and Seville oranges. That's a simple, actionable step.
If you're on warfarin, clopidogrel, codeine, or certain antidepressants, ask about pharmacogenetic testing. You mentioned it's increasingly covered by insurance.
Medicare covers CYP2C19 and CYP2D6 testing for certain indications. Many commercial insurers cover it for warfarin dosing. The cost has come down dramatically. It used to be hundreds or thousands of dollars, and now it's often under $200 out of pocket, even without insurance. Given that a single adverse drug reaction can land you in the hospital with a bill in the tens of thousands, that's a pretty compelling value proposition.
The age factor is something people can be proactive about. If you're over 65 and you've been on the same dose of a medication for years, it's worth asking whether your current dose still makes sense given age-related changes in metabolism.
The specific question to ask is this drug primarily cleared by the liver or the kidneys, and would age-related changes affect my dosing? It's not confrontational, it's just good pharmacology. The dose you needed at 45 might not be the dose you need at 70, and doctors are generally receptive to that conversation if you frame it in terms of pharmacokinetics rather than just, I want a lower dose.
Don't self-adjust. But do self-educate. Know which enzyme handles your medication. Know whether it has a narrow therapeutic window where the 5-half-life rule might not be sufficient. Know whether you're taking something that's a prodrug that needs activation, because those are the ones where genetic variability in CYP enzymes really matters.
Use the resources that exist. The FDI has a drug interaction checker. There are apps like Hippocrates and Medscape that list CYP metabolism pathways. The Flockhart table I mentioned is the gold standard for clinicians. None of this is hidden knowledge. It's just that nobody tells you it exists when you pick up your prescription.
The information asymmetry in pharmacology is wild. The pharmacist knows. The doctor knows. The drug company definitely knows. And the patient gets a label that says, take with food and avoid grapefruit juice, with no explanation of why.
That why matters because once you understand the mechanism, you can reason about other things. If you know grapefruit inhibits CYCYP3A4, and you know your drug is metabolized by CYCYP3A4, you don't need a warning label for every single CYCYP3A4 inhibitor. You can look it up yourself. You've got a mental model that generalizes.
Which is really what this whole conversation is about. The 5 half-life rule is a useful heuristic, but it's not a guarantee. Most drugs follow first-order kinetics and are effectively gone after 5 half-lives. But the exceptions, zero-order drugs, drugs with narrow therapeutic windows, drugs affected by genetic polymorphisms, are common enough that blind faith in the rule is dangerous.
The factors that affect metabolism, age, genetics, disease, diet, other drugs, aren't just academic footnotes. They're the difference between a drug working, not working, or causing harm. Understanding them isn't just for pharmacologists. It's for anyone who takes medication and wants to be an informed participant in their own care.
One thing I want to circle back to. You mentioned that CYP3A4 metabolizes about 50% of all drugs. That's an astonishing concentration of responsibility in a single enzyme. It's like having one airport security lane for half the passengers in the country.
It's not even the most efficient enzyme. CYCYP3A4 has pretty broad substrate specificity. It'll oxidize a huge range of molecular structures, but it's not particularly fast. CYCYP2D6 is faster but much more selective. Evolution didn't design these enzymes for drug metabolism. They evolved to handle dietary toxins, endogenous hormones, and environmental chemicals. Pharmaceuticals are just molecules that happen to fit into these pre-existing enzymatic machinery.
Which is why drug development involves so much CYP profiling. Before a new drug ever reaches human trials, pharmaceutical companies test it against the major CYP enzymes to see which ones metabolize it, and whether it inhibits or induces any of them. A drug that's a potent CYP3A4 inhibitor is going to have interaction problems with half the pharmacy.
That's actually where I want to leave this. You asked about future directions. One of the most interesting developments in drug design is the attempt to engineer molecules that bypass CYP450 metabolism entirely. If you can design a drug that's excreted unchanged by the kidneys, or metabolized by ubiquitous esterases that don't vary much between people, you eliminate a huge source of inter-individual variability.
Instead of designing the drug and then dealing with the metabolic lottery, you design the drug so there is no lottery.
It's harder than it sounds because you still need the drug to be absorbed, distributed to the right tissue, and bind to the right target. But there are examples. Some of the newer direct oral anticoagulants were designed with more predictable metabolism in mind. And as AI-driven drug design improves, we may see more drugs where the metabolic pathway is an intentional feature rather than an inconvenient afterthought.
On the clinical side, pharmacogenomic testing is probably going to become standard before long. Your CYP profile, which variants you have, the 2D6, 2C9, 2C9, TEEN3A4, and a few A4, and a few others, could be part of your medical record, and your prescriptions could be dosed accordingly from day one. No more guessing. No more start standard and adjust if something goes wrong.
We're not there yet, but we're close. The tests exist. The evidence is strong. The cost has dropped. What's missing is the infrastructure and the clinical habit. But I think within a decade, knowing your CYP genotype will be as routine as knowing your blood type, and arguably more useful on a daily basis.
The standard dose is a statistical fiction that we've all been living with because we didn't have the tools to do better. We're getting the tools now. The question is whether the healthcare system adopts them fast enough.
In the meantime, pay attention to the grapefruit juice sticker. It's trying to tell you something important.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, marine surveys off New Zealand's South Island discovered a seamount whose endemic sponge species collectively filter approximately 1.8 million liters of seawater per day, roughly equivalent to the daily water consumption of a small interwar era textile mill.
Right.
The sponge to textile mill conversion factor is not something I had on my bingo card.
Here's what I'm left with. We live in bodies that are running a chemical processing operation we barely understand, with enzymes that evolved to handle dietary toxins now managing pharmaceuticals they never anticipated, with genetic variations that make each of us a slightly different factory, and with age and disease constantly retuning the machinery. The 5 half-life rule is a decent rule of thumb, but the real story is much more interesting, and knowing even a little of it makes you a more informed patient.
If you take one thing away, make it this. Find out which CYP enzymes handle your medications. It's a 10-minute search that could save you from a serious interaction. The Flockhart table is free. The information is out there. You just have to know to look.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leave us a review if you enjoyed this. It genuinely helps other people find the show. We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.